Welcome to Think Big with Dan and Qasim. Join host Dan Melnick and Qasim Masood as they explore big ideas, limitless possibilities, and engage with visionaries, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders who dare to dream big. Get inspired, motivated, and find practical tips for personal growth. Think big, dream bigger, and ignite your potential.
All right. Welcome to Think Big. Our guest today here is Charlene. Charlene, please tell us where you are in the world and what you do for a living.
Yeah. So my name is Charlene Lee, and I am one of the co-founders of Eatable Popcorn. And this company is actually founded both by myself and my husband. So we create gourmet popcorn that's inspired by the flavors of happy hour. So our flagship products that we first released that were sold on our Shopify store were flavors that were infused with wine, spirits, and cocktail flavorings and made with all natural ingredients and artisanally crafted here we are in Vaughan, Ontario, which is just north of Toronto.
Amazing. And so how did you come up with this idea? I mean, you know, somewhere along the line, obviously you had to have either come across a problem or, you know, found some interest in it for somehow. So let's talk me through the kind of the inception of the business and how it came to be.
Yeah. So my husband and I actually met and bonded in a wine tasting class during our days. So definitely, you know, good food and good drink has always been a part of our story, you know, our early days to even now. And both of us actually don't come from a professionally trained food background. Good food and drink has always just been kind of like a hobby for us, like a passion, a way to kind of connect. So, you know, from our dating days to marriage, like popcorn movie marathon Friday nights were just always a part of our lives. And we'd actually been tinkering on our kitchen stove at home, just experimenting with different popcorn flavors. Popcorn's an amazing vehicle for carrying flavors, not thinking anything of it. Except one day, we were kind of on the way to a friend's housewarming party and went to our local grocery store, tried to find something exciting to bring to the party. And we were just kind of disappointed at the number of kind of indulgent, flavor-forward snack that satisfied your sweet tooth, but you know, most of them were laced with artificial flavors or colors or ingredients, some things that, you know, any sort of like health focused person wouldn't really enjoy putting into their bodies. And then on the flip side, the healthier snacks were just very benign in terms of flavor profiles, like rice cakes, like what have you, like things that didn't really excite. So we literally just went home and we made a batch of one of our favorite flavors, which is like a stovetop caramel recipe on a stovetop. And my husband Vince decided to just throw a shot of single malt scotch into the caramel. And we covered the popcorn with it, popped it in the oven and baked it so that when it came out, it had like a really nice crunch. And then that was the thing we ended up bringing to our party and our gathering with our friends. And everyone just kind of went nuts for it. It was like, what is this sorcery? Like, what is in this caramel? Like, I've never had caramel taste this good with this amount of crunchiness. So that's how the concept of what we did was actually born. But it wasn't until a couple of years ago, Vince and I were actually living in Boston. I was working with a startup at that time, and he had found his way into a community kitchen over there that ran this food incubator program that taught us the ins and outs of starting a food business. And it ended in a sort of pitch day, demo day, where we could pitch a product in front of a panel of judges and experts in the industry. And so what started off as just a way to kind of meet people in the city and like have this hobby maybe turn into like a side hustle ended up placing top two in that competition. And that was our sort of eureka moment where we're like, hey, maybe people really like this popcorn. And idea comes to legs. And at that time, I call it my third life crisis, perhaps. It was just kind of a thing where we're just like, you know what, let's see what we can do with this. Like, let's pack our bags and move back to Toronto where we're from. Our families are there. And we had a young toddler with us at the time. And that was the beginning of Eatable.
That's amazing. I always love this, like the stories of like inceptions of these businesses of owners that I do interviews and podcasts with. Cause I just love hearing like the spark, like the one thing was just like, let's do it. That's like my favorite thing. It's so inspiring. That's amazing. So is the caramel whiskey flavor still one of your best sellers, or do you sell it? Even it is, yeah,
for sure. So we call it our OG flavor. It's called Whiskey on the Pops. So it's got
incredible That's so great.
Stone Top Caramel with like the same single malt scotch that's in it. It continues to be one of our best-selling flavors to date.
Amazing. So I'm curious, you know, does your popcorn flavors, or I guess I'm more curious about the original, just the way you explained it. Like, was that like alcohol infused like that? Or was it just used as like a flavor profile and cooked out like a, you know?
So it was, and it started off as being fully alcohol infused. So, I mean, we took a stovetop caramel recipe and then we added real alcohol in it. And then the alcohol content, though, evaporates as part of the cooking process. So you're left with the notes that you typically would notice if you were a risky drinker. So with scotch, a specific one that we used in that recipe was from the region of Islay. And that region is known for smoky, kind of peaty undertones in the flavoring. So that became residual within the caramel flavor. So you get like a nice flavor that you're familiar with, like everybody loves caramel popcorn, but it's sort of amped up with like these additional notes that in, you know, are like smoky and peaty. So they complement each other really well. So I like to think of it as like grown-up popcorn, like sophisticated popcorn.
That's amazing. Yeah. So tell us what's going on behind you too. What are some of the flavors that we have in your background there? Anything notable or new?
Oh, well, absolutely. So last summer, we actually underwent a full packaging rebrand, which is some of the bags.
Oh, nice.
In me. Previously, and when we launched, we had our product in a black coffee style bag. So we've gone through a couple of iterations since then. But what you see behind me is sort of like our very fun, colorful kind of look and feel, which we reinvented ourselves for success in retail shops. And the best three selling flavors, I would say, in our portfolio are our two caramel flavors. So whiskey being one. Another one is what we call pop the salt and tequila. So it's an aged añejo tequila that's infused into the caramel, and we sprinkle it with lemon salt. So it's like a nice twist, and like unsalted caramel. And then our number one best-selling flavor is this one right here, actually. It's called Pop the Champagne. And it was a Belgian white chocolate covered kettle corn. And then we have these popping sugar crystals that we infuse with like a champagne extract. It's kind of like Pop Rocks from your childhood. And we sprinkle it across the popcorn kernels. So when you eat it, you literally feel popping.
Oh my God, that's amazing. You're speaking my language with that one.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that one has been super fun and people have really loved that one. It's the one that gets featured on our socials all the time. People kind of eat it and they're like, ooh, I actually feel it popping. So it's like you're eating your bubbles. And that one was so well received that we actually got to do a collaboration with the Oscars for that popcorn.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So 2 years ago, or last year, we just finished the 96th Oscars, but the 95th Oscars, somebody from the Academy got a hold of that flavor and they enjoyed it so much that we were invited to collaborate with them. And so we actually had an Oscars limited edition version of Pop the Champagne, which had our original Pop the Champagne recipe with 24 karat edible gold that was sprinkled on top. So it's like you're eating.
That's awesome. That's amazing. So how did that affect your... Curious about like, you know, how that affected your sales with that specific promotion, but also did you see a lot more visibility and interaction after you ran that?
Definitely. So I think that sort of collaboration, it got us a lot of really great PR. So just being an emerging brand within this CPG food space, which is full of amazing products, like it really sort of put us on the map, especially being like a Canadian company, just given the opportunity to work with as high profile of a partner such as the Oscars, like on that sort of stage, really helped establish the credibility in what we do. So it really, I think, just really amped up that unique factor. That, you know, what we do is not a mass market product and there's an occasion for it. And the Oscars had very rarely collaborated within a food products and with a food company before. So to just be a company that they saw as, you know, a good partnership opportunity really opened up a lot of doors for us, just to open that discussion with other partners and sort of just increase our brand awareness overall in both the Canadian and US market.
That is awesome. That is such a cool collaboration. So I'm curious a little bit about, I think you had mentioned, you said you started selling online first and now you kind of gotten into retail. So what does that kind of breakdown look like for you these days between the revenue that you're gaining from Any retail deals that you have versus what you're selling direct to consumer online?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we launched our company in 2019 and we just, had three SKUs at the time, three flavors that we perfected over the course of a year in a commercial kitchen. And we threw up a Shopify store in January 2019. Little did we know that shortly thereafter would be resulting in a, a global pandemic type of situation. But it was one of these things where selling online was the quickest and easiest starting point for us and as a small brand. So it was super grassroots at the time. Like I threw up a Shopify store. First order was my dad. And after my dad bought from us, we started running, influencer campaigns. I just gifted products to a couple of local influencers on Instagram and really just let it get out into the world through word of mouth, through what we were able to do at the time on social. And I still remember that feeling like when the first order came in from someone I didn't know. And I was like, this is real now. We're actually selling popcorn out of our basement to somebody who actually wanted to try it. And since then, like 6 months into that journey, and just due to our work efforts on Instagram and sort of building a community around our brand, we got our first couple of inquiries from large retailers. So one of our first retailers was actually Saks in Canada, who found us on social and then inquired about our products, and we sent them some samples, and that led to our first kind of like retailer placement. And I kind of want to say, like, we didn't even really anticipate it at the time. Like, I just wanted to sell popcorn online and have it be kind of like an online business to start. But what I think that did for us, the way we started was we were able to test our products and get market validation at a premium price point with a very unique offering and start basically getting revenue into our business and validating our products and validating, customer feedback, making sure the pricing kind of worked, using social as a platform to kind of push popcorn in places that people weren't really used to seeing popcorn before. Like our first couple of influencer campaigns, I remember I was trying to drive the idea of popcorn to appear in places that people don't typically expect to see it. So, I mean, I guess when you think popcorn, typically you think, okay, I'm going to eat it in a movie theater or maybe at the carnival or something like that. It's a very kind of like basic snack. But our first couple of influencer campaigns showed the popcorn in a wine glass. And one of the influencers was like in a bath with like a Netflix on her laptop, like right beside her bathtub with like pop the champagne popcorn in a wine glass. And that was Self-Care Sunday. And then we had like another influencer during the pandemic set up this really elaborate setup at a drive-in movie theater where she like popped the trunk open at the back of her car and had these lush blankets and pillows. And it was just like a very bougie drive-in setup with like eatable popcorn.
That's awesome.
Like popcorn as a cake topper on desserts, popcorn on our charcuterie board, popcorn even as like as a cocktail garnish. So like I knew from the beginning.
It's so creative. I love that.
Thank you. People thought it was wild at the time. They're like, what? Like, can you really do this with popcorn? And I was like, yeah, because we're doing it. You see it. You see the visual. We're pushing it to the next level. So that was super fun.
That's amazing. So you got the first kind of retail deal with Saks in Canada. How has that expanded since you had your first retail deal? Are you in do you have any deals with any other larger chains in the US or Canada now?
Yeah, so I mean, being a Canadian-based company, we of course started in our own backyard. So we expanded to a lot of the well-known department stores in Canada. It was a very giftable premium product. So names like Hudson's Bay or Indigo, which is kind of like the Canadian equivalent of Barnes and Noble,
Oh, okay, interesting.
a whole bunch of like independent gift shops like across the country. And then last year we made a very solid push into the US market as well. So on the online channel, we had already seen a lot of success with partners like Uncommon Goods. So anyone who offers very curated premium giftable products saw a lot of success with Eatable. Last year, right before the holidays, we were able to roll out to 160 plus locations of Total Wine and More. So it was a great fit and a natural fit for our brand, just being alcohol infused and then you're picking it up in the place where you go and buy a bottle of wine on a Friday night. So
That's amazing. So I'm curious, I know you said you're kind of making a push with the online, with your online channels into the US. Other than the influencer side of things, or maybe it's just that, but what kind of like other marketing strategies or efforts have you tried that have been working? Did you try anything that was maybe didn't work out as well as you maybe thought? How have you found success doing online sales in the US market?
So I think we first started dabbling in paid ads in 2021, I kind of want to say. So, I mean, in the first 2 years, it was all about just growing very organically, appearing at markets, doing things very locally. And through influencer campaigns, whatever they looked at like at that time. But we didn't really spend much money on paid acquisition. So in 2021, when we grew a bit, we started hiring agencies to run paid ads for us on Google and on Facebook, now Meta. And that's sort of where we started. And I think at that time, that was like the hype of e-commerce. Like that was when everything really took off. So it was like one of those situations where we were in the right place at the right time with the right offering. And we really, really grew our channel at that time. There was a year where we like doubled our revenue. In
Wow.
that we were just and just slowly ramping up ad spend. So we had an agency that we worked with that really helped us understand what the cycle was like in paid ads and how in the first couple of months you may not be profitable, but it's an investment that you have to make to help the algorithm kind of figure out what is the secret sauce that works for you, what is the offering and the price point and the right AOV and making sure all of your costs and your margins work. And I think we grew that way quite sustainably for a better part of like the next year and a half until iOS 14 kicked in and made customer acquisition costs a lot more expensive. We also ran into a point with that current agency where it was like, hey, we can only do so much on, with static images and raw video content. Like we need more from you guys. Like we need way more video assets. Like that's when, Instagram was moving and really investing heavily on Reels and like TikTok was on the rise and like all that video-based content. So as founders and as a very small team, and then I had up until that point been doing all of the marketing myself. Like I didn't have any outside help on social or marketing or anything. So I was doing all the things, wearing all the hats. And it felt really overwhelming for us to be founders that now had to like be content creators because we sort of grew that company leveraging other people's or other content creators' skill sets, and to have to now put attention to that felt really challenging for me at the time. So me being a mom, like I had family sort of stuff at home and then managing this business, and now with the focus of it being content creation, it's a very fast-moving thing. There's trends and all of that stuff. It's very quick and dynamic. It felt like a challenge for us. So we cycled through a few other agency partners that went from helping us with the content creation in-house. And to be honest, that's been like one of the biggest challenges, right? Because there's so many schools of thought around, agencies and what they can do for you and what a founder's role should be in that agency. So I think it's always been an area in our business where we always want to make sure that whoever it is that we're working with, whether it's an outsourced resource or like an in-house resource, and we've tried both, is really just like continuing to grow the business and continuing to do the things that matter for that growth. So being an online company, I think social and paid has always been a core of our online growth there. It's just keeping up with all of the changes that are happening, like with the algorithm and like with the style of content. But leading up till now, I think there's definitely, an increased focus and importance of, founders actually showing up and being the face of their own business. So I'm still learning this and trying to be comfortable in my own skin about this, but I've just been told by so many people, it's really important to show up. It's really important to be a face on your grid because people, like customers, want to know who's behind the business now. They support like mission-driven businesses that align with their own set of personal values. So that's something that we're continuing to kind of make strides
Yeah,
towards.
it's so true because you're kind of customer profile, no matter what kind of business you are, nowadays, you know, if somebody wasn't a customer for you that didn't want to pay maybe a little extra, or maybe, you know, weren't interested in buying, you know, things from local creators or things like that, then they just go buy Lay's potato chips at the grocery store. But that's not who your buyers are. But the buyers who are yours, they do want to see that kind of stuff. So it's so true. Yeah, I'm glad you're embracing that. But I know it's a lot. That's one of the biggest, like, I would say, like, sources of variability in a lot of the businesses I talk to, is like how they handle their marketing. Because a lot of people who become entrepreneurs and start their own companies have a strong marketing background. So they either think they can do it all themselves just because they know and have done it for so long, but realize there's so much else going on that they just don't have the time. So they outsource to an agency or they hire a team. I'm always interested to hear, you know, like what kind of like marketing strategies and setups people have, because some people really get away with, you know, it's just like, you know, someone like you who's a CEO and they do everything themselves, wear all the hats, and it's just them and maybe the wife or their husband or something, and they do everything somehow, get away with it, just doing like all day and night every day. It's like really impressive. But then, you know, somewhere along the line, it seems, you know, folks tend to outsource, whether it's through agencies or contractors or things like that. So I'm always interested. It sounds like you've kind of had a taste of all of it, where, you know, you worked with agencies that went well for a while, then you tried an in-house team. And so are you kind of back to, you know, just kind of managing it on your own now? Are you still working with an agency? Do you have anybody like on the payroll doing marketing, or is it kind of back to you at this point?
I think we're still working with agency. Like
Okay.
marketing is the area in our business where we have happily found, good fits with agency partners because and the reason being just as you said, like no founder ever comes into a business with all the skills. And
Right.
so I actually come from a finance background. That's for a whole other story, but like I've always felt like I was naturally a creative person. But just from a professional and schooling and education standpoint, went through a finance stream. So I came out the other side with like very strong understanding and comfort level over numbers, which has been super impactful in a business. But always felt like marketing was this thing that lit me up and I've always wanted to explore. But because I never had the professional training of like, schooling or going through like marketing education necessarily, it's always been a part where okay, I can understand something at a high level or what we're trying to do, like, self-learning, all of these things, like what goes into managing an email list, or what does customer retention look like, or what are the metrics that matter in e-commerce, like that you look at on your Shopify dashboard. Like, I've always had an appreciation for managing our business against metrics, which is that's like the analytical side of me. But on another side, it's like I've always enjoyed leaning on agency partners who are working with a large variety of other types of clients because I feel like they can use best practices from a whole bunch of other companies in like a whole bunch of other verticals even and apply those same best practices towards us. So I've never really seen our company as a food brand and I do things the way typical CPG companies in the food space do them. I really enjoy the idea of taking best practices from fashion, lifestyle, retail. Like we even had a partnership a couple of years back with an NFT company where we made pot custom popcorn for an NFT company and they sent it out to all of their holders, right? Like stuff like
That's
that,
awesome.
being able to leverage best practices and things from other industries, I think is just my way of being like, I don't want to be like everyone else because there are good things about this industry and that industry that I can take into my business. And that's our unique spin on this. Like, I'm not really here to be like everyone else and do things the way that everyone else is doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's clearly evident even just from this conversation, right? And it's funny you say that about, you know, if you could find a good partnership like with an agency, it can be so valuable as long as it's the right relationship. And I actually had a conversation with somebody recently who had just gotten around to funding, and apparently the group of investors that invested in their company required them to do their marketing through an agency. Like, they didn't want them to do it in-house, they didn't want to do it themselves. They're like, we'll give you the money, but one of the stipulations is like you have to work with like one of these agencies that we know does a really good job, because they know every industry and they'll be able to bring in expertise, you know, from all these other areas, and, you know, use those advantages to fit into, you know, how it works for you. So I think you really hit the nail on the head with that. I think that's a really positive perspective to have on that front of things. And so, you know, if we were to kind of speak again like a year from now, you know, 2025, how do you see the growth as you're, you know, penetrating US markets now and, you know, continue to nurture your retail relationships? What kind of growth are you expecting this year from a percentage or a number standpoint? And how do you see the e-commerce versus retail side of the business growing respective of each other as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty loaded question, but we had a really aggressive goal coming into this year to yet again double our revenues. And
Love that.
really happy to say that as a small business, as a small woman-owned business, we've achieved seven-figure revenues over the last 2 years during some really challenging times. And I know that stat is stacked against us as a small business and a woman-owned business. So that's something, that's an achievement that we're really proud of that we've been able to accomplish. So this year, we had some really ambitious goals to double that revenue and also start to open ourselves up to fundraising opportunities as well, just because we're at that next point of scale. And to grow in retail is quite expensive. There's so many kind of marketing expense items that as an e-commerce business, you don't really have to think about, like, you know, locking up crazy amounts of inventory to forecast for what a retail buyer would want, or, you know, trade marketing expenses and investments in how much you need to sort of allocate for each purchase order back to a retailer to ensure and to achieve sell-through and stuff. So those are the things that we're continuing to learn and grow within that side of the industry. I think now more than ever, just now that the global pandemic is behind us, it's really gone to highlight that the most successful companies out there, or the most successful brands, are the ones that truly take an omni-channel approach to their marketing. So, for example, like we started out very much as an e-commerce focused company, invested in online growth. And that has brought data points that we're now able to bring to a retailer to demonstrate validation, demand, and possible sell-through at retail locations because of the success we've been able to achieve just on our own online store sales. We are starting to expand into channels like Amazon, which it's crazy to me to think that in the last 5 years we haven't touched it, but I think it was just a part of it was just like, okay, let me just validate this product, validate the price point and everything works, and then dive into the beast of Amazon. So we're sort of doing those two parallels, but I think very much so like they complement each other. So in the old environment, I think traditional, you like as a CPG brand, as a food brand, when you think about growth, you usually think about like one stream to focus on. So, like a lot of my own counterparts in this industry have chosen from day one to focus on grocery retail growth. That is a very traditional path of a CPG company where you just want to get into retailers first. And it wasn't until the pandemic that it kind of highlighted how important your online presence and owning the customer and owning that customer relationship really was. So we kind of tackled it the other way around, where we went e-commerce first as a food brand, and then now we're trying to like use that and leverage that success over to retail. So my hope for the next year is to just continue growing on both sides of like the business, in both channels, and as well as coming out with some fresh and exciting flavor innovations that are more every day. So we started off as a confectionery flavor-based popcorn company, which lends itself to a bit of seasonality in our business. So retail, for example, you know, seasonality should be is not as favored, I guess. Like you want to be something that people can shop for all year round in the grocery
Right.
store. We understand that sometimes in order to position our product that way, we'll need to come up and tweak our offerings a little bit so that our flavors and our product become a little bit more every day.
What do you find is like the seasonality of it? Is it kind of like winter holiday time? You find
For
more?
sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean,
Interesting.
just like sweet tooth, like Christmas and holidays, like
Like
two, three,
gifting.
four
Yeah.
is like the prime time for popcorn.
Right.
So, like, we've learned this almost like the hard way as well, because that's a natural wave for our business and our product where I don't really have to try too hard to sell at that time because that messaging of like popcorn being something you gift, something you enjoy with your family around the brunch table is like top of mind for all our customers at that time. But even if I like forced you to buy popcorn in like a time when maybe you don't really think about it, like I don't know, March or April necessarily, right?
Now.
Or even January, right? Like everybody's
Right.
like New Year's resolution mode, not wanting, you know, wanting to cut back on sugar,
Yeah, that's
alcohol,
true.
and all of that.
Yeah.
You kind of can't force it. And we've tried. We've tried to position ourselves that way. But I think sometimes it's kind of like don't keep going upstream, like go with what works. Like put your feelers out and see what the market demands. And if our customer is demanding, you know, a more everyday version of our product that maybe is not confectionery, but maybe possibly over to the savory profile, that's what we're going to lean on to. So I think we spent the last couple of years really like validating our product, listening to the customer, understanding our customer. And now if our customers are saying, we want to find you in the grocery store and we will purchase at this price point and we know how we stack up next to the competition, that's what we're going to lean into over the next year.
That's amazing. It's funny. I had a podcast actually just a couple of days ago. I don't think it's posted yet, but you might see it if you follow us. He is a hot chocolate seller, right? So, and he's like almost all retail. And he mentioned that he's like, you know, it's obviously very seasonal. For some reason, I happened to the call. I was like, I didn't even think about like the fact that hot chocolate is very, it's one of the most seasonal things you can sell. And his perspective on it was actually really interesting. And he said, he's like, you know, basically, like you said, he's like, I tried to like, you know, try to do messaging that like, you know, doesn't make hot chocolate like a year, like a, you know, a seasonal thing, but a year round thing. He's like, but eventually I kind of just leaned into it and figured that, you know, if I do keep this and I continue like, you know, nurturing these retail relationships that buy it seasonally, you know, I can make sure that I have little to almost no waste. So like, I'm not hemorrhaging anything from like, you know, things being, you know, spoiled or like past their expiration. And I know exactly how much they're going to buy every year because of, you can see exactly what they sold last year. So it's like, in a way, it kind of makes things a little simpler for us because we can kind of like take some time like for the rest of the year to, you know, figure things out in the back end that we need to do and make sure that our, you know, execution on the deals that we do like in the busy winter time is perfectly, you know, efficient with, and we know exactly how much we need. You know, we continue to kind of nurture those relationships there. So he actually had a very seemingly positive perspective on the fact that his was seasonal. It really seemed to lean into it.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point too, because I think even when you talk about like investors or if some people have like an eventual exit strategy and, you know, talk about topics like how to maximize your valuation, I think no matter what you do and what channels you operate in, the one of the ways that you do this is by creating a model in your business of predictability. So I think e-commerce, you know, it's easy to do that because you have analytics and data that you can lean on and you can look at last year's performance and adjust it for an annual forecast. And same thing with a retailer too. As we're growing and we can sort of like reinvest back into these retailer relationships, you're just trying to forecast what your current year looks like based on what you know has happened already. So I think that's a really good way to look at it, because when we talk about seasonality, you know, you can now focus on having the most kick-ass Q3 and Q4 you can have, which can cover some of the lulls that you might experience in Q1, Q2.
Exactly.
So that too, yeah.
Yeah, it was just really interesting because, you know, he was like, well, from the outside looking in, like if you're a person like looking to start a brand or a business and you have no idea what you're going to do, but you know, like you want it in like food and beverage space, like your last thought would be, let me try to sell something that like only sells 3 months out of the year. You know, it's like, why would you do that? But he was like, it didn't even occur to me until like we got into these relationships and I realized like we're only selling things for like 3 months. But then, yeah, well, I'll reiterate again, just kind of his point of like, and what you say with like the predictability of it can make it very efficient, make sure you don't have any waste. And again, you know, like you say, just have like a really, really kick ass, like, you know, Q3 or Q4 probably in his case, and we're like rolling into Q1. I just thought that was a really interesting perspective. So let me just ask you one final question that I like to ask everybody on the pod. You'll see if you watch any of them, it's usually me and Dan's last question. If you could go back to kind of like, you know, your inception of starting the business, knowing everything that you know now, what would be like the biggest piece of advice that you'd give yourself starting fresh from day one again?
You don't know what you don't know, right? And so somebody like me who was super, super calculated, super type A, needed to plan my future, set my goals, work towards that. I was a really big perfectionist because I was obsessed with this idea of like, I needed to know exactly where my destination is and I needed to reverse engineer this path towards that destination. But I think my biggest piece of advice would just be like, that's just a general direction, but your path will likely veer off course like a lot more than you think it would. So don't worry about taking steps only when something feels perfect, because in your mind you think, okay, like this is what it should be. And I know what I'm trying to get to, and I'm not going to release it out to the world until in my mind it's perfect. But it's actually not about what we think. It's about what the customer thinks. So the faster you can get something out there into the world and be open and vulnerable to receiving feedback from your market, that is what we should be doing. Even if it's not perfect, even if it's like 75% done, Just get it out there, get the feedback, and spend your time working on that last 25% with more validation. And I think we could have probably launched a lot more and faster. And the things that didn't work out, we would have found out sooner, had we not been stuck in our own minds and been super perfectionist about what we were putting out there.
I think that's fantastic advice. I think any, young or newer entrepreneur watching that, should definitely take that. And because it's true, right? Like, you can try to pre-plan for as much as you can to avoid, to avoid roadblocks beforehand. But, in the grand scheme, if you avoid one, it's because you go a direction, you're just going to find another, right? Like you might avoid one beforehand, but something else is going to come. And like you say, like it's about the customer. You know what your plan is, your ultimate goal. There's a million ways to get there. There's going to be roadblocks at every turn, no matter what you do. So I think, like you say, it's a really good point is, just get it out there, go and do it, and just do whatever you have to do, to make that goal become a reality, right? I think that's fantastic advice. So that's awesome. Well, listen, I really appreciate your time today. Man, if somebody wants to get in touch with you, keep tabs with the company and maybe make a purchase or two. Let them know what your socials are and how to find you on the website and all that good stuff.
Yeah, definitely. So, our website is eatable.com, EATABLE, eatable.com, and you can find us on all the socials at Eatable Inc. So it's Eatable INC on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook. Yeah, thanks so much for having me on this. It was great talking to you, Matt, and hopefully, everybody gets a chance to try it out, and always connect with me on LinkedIn and let me know what your thoughts are. I always love to hear it.
Absolutely, will do. Yeah, I really appreciate your time too. I'll talk to you soon, okay?
All right. Thanks, Matt.
Take care.